This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you've ever paged through the Very Hungry Caterpillar or a Good Night Moon with a child on your lap or under the covies, don't you instinctively feel that reading to kids must be good for them? I mean, that it helps their developing brains? Well, you'd be right, because research shows that when parents and kids read together, kids have bigger vocabularies, better language skills, and may find it easier to start reading on their own. So no wonder the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends making a daily dose of reading doctor's orders. In a minute, we'll be asking you, parents, kids, and librarians, to call in and share your favorite science kids books. But first, what is it? What is it about kids' books that make them such good brain builders? My next guest analyzed the text of 100 kids' books to find out. Jessa Montag is talks about the science of story time. She's an assistant research psychologist, University of California, Riverside, and she's author of a study out last month in Psychological Science. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Your study was specific about the text of the kids' books. Why focused on the text?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as you mentioned, we've known for a while that there are a lot of benefits to reading to kids in terms of vocabulary and language development and later literacy. The real question is why? You know, it could be something a lot less interesting that more affluent parents are more likely to read to their kids. So these positive outcomes we see are really just a consequence of other benefits of coming from a more affluent family. Other thoughts are it has to do with this really great one-on-one time between parents and kids that's going on during this reading. But one thing that I think has been a little less studied is the actual contribution of the text itself. So really the guiding question for this work was what might the text of the books be providing that everyday speech is not for these children.
Mm-hmm. And you compared kids' books to conversations parents had with the kids.
Yes, that's right.
Explain a little bit for us.
Yeah, so we got the conversations from a collection of transcribed interactions between caregivers and children. These conversations were largely collected as a part of other studies, but they're now available for researchers like us who might want samples of either early childhood speech or, as we did here, early speech to children. We compared all that that sample of speech to a collection of book text that we compiled ourselves. As you mentioned, we got a list of 100 different picture books taken largely from lists of teacher and librarian recommended books, Amazon bestsellers, and circulation statistics from the local public library. And in doing this, we were able to have a nice sample of speech to kids and a nice sample of picture book text to compare to each other.
Mm-hmm. So how big was the difference between the kids' books and the regular speech? Well, what did you find?
Yeah, so what we found was when we compared our text of transcribed books to an equally sized amount of speech to kids, we found about 70% more unique words in the books than in the speech. And I should qualify that a bit, that 70% isn't going to be a magic number or anything. That's tied to the sample size we use and various methodological choices we made. So really the takeaway point is that they were clearly and substantially more unique words in the text of the picture books than in a matched sample of the speech to kids.
Huh. And did you come out of this study with a new favorite kids book for yourself?
Bark George was a really cute one about a dog who won't bark and is instead meowing and mooing, and turns out the dog had swallowed all sorts of other animals, and that's why the dog is meowing and mooing. But then at the end of the book, it turns out the dog swallowed the vet and is saying hello. That was just pretty adorable.
Well, you know, that's the great thing about kids' books is that they let you think. They let the kids think outside of the box, right? There's no penalty for that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think a real benefit of books is that it introduces new topics and new words that are generally outside the scope of a child's day-to-day life. You know, a lot of speech to kids is a lot of, you know, aren't those carrots good? Put on your shoes, things like that. But books allow you to talk about more different things in more different contexts, you know, even without actually being there.
Yeah, and you know, there are no right or wrong answers like there might be in school where they expect you to come up with something. You're free to think, you know, come up with new ideas.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of, you know, really fun play with stories and with language.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice any trends in the kids' books you studied?
You know, one thing that actually popped out at me quite a bit was something that other people have pointed out as well, that in a lot of the books, the role of women is often very stereotypical, feminine, and there's a really alarming lack of representation of any people of color. Yeah, you know, and all this was a little bit beyond the scope of what we were interested in studying, but given that we know that reading to children is associated with both income and race, it seems like getting a bit more diversity in the books would ultimately be a good thing for getting books into families.
Yeah. So where do you go from here? What else would you like to study next?
So one thing that we're really interested in is looking at sentence level differences between books and text. You know, we tend to not say passives very much in our speech, but we write them quite a bit. And so this is another perhaps important benefit that the text of books is giving to children that they may not be encountering in their day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm. So you would say then that the text of the book is very important when you're reading to kids. It's not just the pictures that are the important parts.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's the text and the types of sentences, rarer sentences, more complex sentences, as well as, you know, rarer words that may not be, you know, something that you'd say if it weren't printed in the text.
Well, Jessica, thank you for taking time to talk with us today. Fascinating.
Yeah. Thanks so much. It was great to be here.
You're welcome. Jessica Montag is an assistant research psychologist at UC Riverside. When it comes to choosing a book to read, there's always the classics, The Cat in the Hat, The Runaway Bunny. But if you're looking for great kids' books, science-oriented kids' books, there's plenty of new classics out there to discover. And my next guests are going to help us build a list of books for the science-curious kids. I number myself among them. Let me introduce them to you. Maria Popova. Maria Popova is the editor and founder of BrainPickings.org. Maria, great to have you back on our studio.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Jacob Berkowitz is a science writer and author of the kids' book Jurassic Poop, What Dinosaurs and Others Left Behind, as well as the adult book The Stardust Revolution, The New Story of Our Origin in the Stars. He brought together a few of his favorite science books for kids for the website Scientist's Bookshelf last year, and he joins us today from Ottawa. Welcome, Jacob.
Hi, Ira and Maria. Great to be a part of this conversation.
And I want to remind our parents and kids and school librarians out there, give us a call. Tell us about your favorite science book. Our kids' science book number is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can call us up and let us know. You can also send us a tweet at SciFry if you'd rather do it that way. Let me begin by talking about the books. Maria, what's your favorite book? Have you got one you're going to pass along to us?
My favorite, I have many favorite children's science books, but I think my favorite one is called Me, Jane, which is about Jane Goodall's childhood, and it's by a British artist and writer named Patrick MacDonald. It came out in 2011. Apart from the really just purely lovely illustrations, it has the benefit of actually validating the idea that a child can dream to become something kind of kooky and then live to be that and to revolutionize that kooky field.
Yeah, we have had you on many times to talk about books, and you always bring on a kid's book or two. What it is that what there is about kids' books that you like?
Well, I should mention that I don't really think, I mean, I side with J.R. Tolkien, who believed that there was no such thing as writing for children. And Murray Sendak, too, in his very final interview said, I don't write for children, I write. And somebody says, that's for children. And we do that. I think great children's books are great books. And in fact, I think we need to be even more discerning in what, in how much slack we cut. I remember an interview with Susan Sontag who said that 10% of what is published is actually literature, meaning 10% of books merit being called literature. And I think when we deal with a narrow field, we get a little overly excited because there are so few children's science books that we are just so excited that there is something about, say, microbiology that we don't consider what makes it great.
Mm-hmm. Jacob, you've written books for kids and adults. How would you react to this?
Well, I totally agree. When people ask me, like, what age group do I write for, I say 5 to 95. And I think a lot of people think that's just a crass marketing pitch. But I truly believe that. I mean, any good science book, you know, whether it's a parent or a grandparent who's sitting down with a young child to read the book, Most people, the last time they took a science course was in high school, probably the early years of high school. And so with many of the books we're probably going to talk about today, the content is going to be new and interesting and fascinating to the 4 or 5 year old, or 7 or 8 year old, and the adult at the same time.
You know, when people ask me about Science Friday, what age do you pitch it at? I can't give them an age either.
Mm.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Mm.
You know, right? We do stuff that everybody, hopefully, will be able to understand. We have a lot of people on the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's see if we can take a suggestion or two. Let's go to Linda in Kingston, Massachusetts. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yeah, one of my favorite science books to share is titled Big Bang, The Tongue-Tickling Tale of a Speck That Becomes Spectacular by Carolyn DiCristofano. This book, one of the things I love about it, it reads like a poem and explains the Big Bang Theory in easy-to-understand terms. In addition to the beautifully written text, the illustrations by Michael Carroll add to the reading experience. And this is a book I have shared with my family, as well as students that I have taught as a school librarian in the Silver Lake Regional School District in Kingston.
Wow,
it's always a big hit.
Sounds like a great book. Big Bang Theory in easy-to-understand language. Thank you. Thank you for suggesting that. Jacob, do you have a book that you'd like to suggest?
Sure. Well, let's go from the Big Bang to Animal Puke, just to mix things up a little bit. And this is a book called Get the Scoop on Animal Puke. And I, really echoing what the first caller said, for me, and when I'm writing for kids or adults, I think the language is enormously important, as the researcher was talking about. And I think back to Dr. Seuss and, his first books, and when he was going around to sell those books. Initially, publishers said, well, there's no, that was the days, 1950s, it was See Dick and Jane Run was considered, pedagogically appropriate. And he was writing these very poetic, rhythmic, rhyming books. And many people said, well, this isn't going to help kids. Well, now we know that, it's exactly the opposite. And, so Get the Scoop on Animal Puke, I think, is really aimed at what's often called the reluctant readers, often boys, age 6, 7, 8, and it uses enormously. I mean, how can you talk about animal puke? And it's amazingly across the animal kingdom. It's fun. It's tons, lots of facts. There's a kind of a mix of the gross out factor in there. But at its core, what it does is pull together all of these diverse examples of vomiting. And show that there are these patterns, underlying patterns within the animal kingdom that join species. So you get this bigger evolutionary story through surprise animal puke.
Talking with Maria Popova and Jacob Berkowitz on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Coming up with a reading list for you, a book list for kids, science books, and as we're talking, we're realizing that we're all kids, right? And science books really can be read by everybody. Maria, help us build that list.
There's a lovely book called You Are Stardust by a Canadian environmental writer named Ellen Kelsley and a Korean-Canadian illustrator named Seon Kim. It is extraordinarily beautiful. All the artwork is actually three-dimensional dioramas that Kim built out of tactile materials, which were then photographed and digitally composted into the story. And the story is about how everything in our daily lives is related to ancient cosmic history, from the water in your sink that used to quench the dinosaurs to the air that comes out when you sneeze that dates back millennia. And it does a really great job in a very simple and poetic way of introducing the unfamiliar through the familiar.
Hmm. Very, very interesting, because, the water's been around for billions of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same water.
And the same molecules we breathe. They're Marie Curie's and Albert Einstein's. Yeah.
And Jacob, your second pick?
It's a combo, and it really riffs on what Maria was saying. This is the idea of kind of big ideas for little people. And the first book is one called Next Time You See the Moon by Emily Morgan. It's from the National Science Teachers Association Books is the publisher. And it's from a series where it says, based on the next time you see. And for many kids, you know, they in living in cities, they're not going to see stars, but they will see the, you know, every night that the moon is out, there's a good chance they'll be able to see the moon. And it's one of the major ways we get a sense of that we're actually living on a planet that's orbiting, you know, other than day and night. And, you know, I think that it's one way parents can talk about, you know, what a child's seeing in his day-to-day life and this bigger question of mm-hmm. planetary sciences and living mm-hmm. on a planet. And I'll bring up the next one with the next suggestion.
All right, let me go. Well, before the break, let's see if we can get Shirley from Howard County, Maryland, on the phone. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I adore Chameleon Chameleon by Joy Calley as a read-aloud. It's a photographic journey of a chameleon who needs to leave his tree and go to a new tree because he needs to find more food. He encounters different things in his environment. He changes colors. There's a double-page spread of his tongue coming out and catching a fly. First and second graders are all over it. And the back matter is very rich and full of different resources and the science of why the color changes, what's happening in the environment of chameleons.
Wow. Wow. And you're a librarian?
Yes, I am. I'm a librarian at Howard County Library System in Maryland.
Do kids come in looking for these books, or do you point them out to them? Kids love reading this kind of book?
Between 17% and 20% of my children's nonfiction are animal books, are science books.
Wow.
You cannot keep great animal books in any of these photographic essays by Nick Bishop.
Wow.
You know, they come in looking for that guy. You know that guy. You know, with the ones with the green cover.
All right. I want that one. They just say, I want that one with the green cover, and you know what they're talking about.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Shelley, for taking time to be with us. We're going to take a break. When we come back, talk lots more with Maria Popova and Jacob Berkowitz. And our number, 844-724-8255. As we go out, a tweet from Jen who says, my kids love Nature's Yucky by Woodlake Nature Center Director of Education Karen Schrag. Gross stuff, followed by easy explanations. Nature's Yucky. We hope we're not too yucky, but we like a little bit of yuck. So we'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about science books for kids with Maria Popova, editor and founder of BrainPickings.org, Jacob Berkowitz, author of books for kids and adults, including Jurassic Poop, with Dinosaurs and Others Left Behind. And if you have your favorite science kids books to share, give us a call, 844-724-8255. We have a lot of people on Facebook and tweets coming in. On Facebook, Ariana Duke says, for teenagers, Colonel Chris Hadfield's An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth is great. Yeah, he's a terrific guy, right? And Janet Cruz suggests Find the Constellation by H.A. Ray. A tweet in from Donna who says, gotta go, gotta go. Sam Swope and Sue Riddle about monarch migration. I use it to teach young ones very rhythmic. And Le Petit Prince, The Little Prince. Remember that
Absolutely.
One? Absolutely. Left a strong impression, Space Bronco says. Left a strong impression with me. Love the idea of one being to each planet. Mm. You like that book?
It's my favorite book of all time.
Is that right?
So I side with the tweeter.
What do you love so much about it?
It's an allegory of almost every immutable question of human life.
Well, you know, The Martian, which was a book about it, now mm-hmm. made into a movie coming out, was about how it was to escape Mars. Let's see if we can go to the let me get some more picks first from both of you. Maria, what would you add next to our book list?
So I think as important as introducing kids to new words is introducing kids to new cultures and people they wouldn't encounter at home. There's a lovely book called The Amazing Discoveries of Avicenna, spelled I-B-N-S-I-N-A, who was the Persian polymath, authored 450 known works and possibly many more on math, astronomy, philosophy, poetry, and most notably medicine. He wrote the a book called the Canon of Medicine, which remained in circulation for 600 years after his death and was kind of the medieval education in medicine. But what I find really extraordinary about this book is that it comes from two Middle Eastern women, a Lebanese writer and an Iran-based Iraqi illustrator. And there's something really wonderful about how in our day when so much of the cultural narrative about the Arab world has been hijacked by a small faction of extremists and the kind mm-hmm. of anti-scientific beliefs under that, here's a reminder that actually so much of modern science came from the golden age of Islamic sciences, yeah. and maybe hope that we can both reclaim that and rekindle that.
Good point. Jacob, your next pick.
Yeah, it's a it's a riff on speaking of the Little Prince. This is a book called Buried Sunlight. It's published by Scholastic. The authors are Molly Bang and Penny Chisholm, and this gets to the kind of core of what's our relationship with our sun, our star that we share. You know, the sun, and it's a book about climate change. But it brings it back to a very personal level, and I love the way that this book uses the concept of, the sun on your face and makes the connections between the warmth that you feel, the sun on your face, and plants and the growth of plants turning into fossil fuels and then mining those fossil fuels and the effect that has on, when they're burned on heating up the planet. So again, it's one of these ways of approaching a very big idea, complex idea, global climate change, planetary science, but through the wonderful kind of entry point of just the warmth of the sun on your face.
Interesting way to introduce people to it. Let's go to the phones. Donna in Gulf Breeze, Florida. Hi, Donna. Go ahead.
Hi, Ira.
Hey there.
My mother-in-law got my daughter the book called Girls Who Looked Under Rocks, and it profiles a number of women scientists as young girls and how they got their interest in science. So it's actually changed my daughter's mind. She doesn't mind getting dirty. She doesn't mind working in the garden and digging up worms. She does stay away from snakes, but that's what my husband's doing. She still doesn't like getting her face wet in the shower, but she'll play with dirt till the cows come home.
And so it really, as you say, really did change her life from reading a book.
Yes. Because it showed her that it's not just boys who go out and look under rocks and find things interesting, because she did, and some of the boys were making fun of her. And we said, well, hold on a second. Look at these women and the contributions that they've made to our scientific discovery. Ignore the boys. Let's go dig in the garden.
That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that with us. Marie, any reacting to that?
Yes, very much so. First of all, I love Mary Anning, the fossil hunter, so I hope she's one of the characters in that book, which I look forward to getting. But another book in the same vein is called Summer Birds, The Butterflies of Maria Marian, who was this amazing 17th century German naturalist and self-taught artist. She started studying insects when she was a little girl, 200 years before there was real science education for women.
Wow.
And then taught herself art and then married the two by doing the most detailed and extensive illustration of butterfly metamorphosis, which forever changed the understanding of both etymology and the natural history illustration. And all the while, she was raising her daughters. And eventually, with one of her young daughters, she traveled to South Africa at a time when women had no mobility and no agency of their own. And then she had a stroke, and she continued to paint and to study after the stroke. Just an extraordinary woman.
It's amazing. Do you think we're seeing more books that girls, or finding girls more interested?
I hope so. I'm very disheartened by a study that came out in 2011 that showed that 31% of children's books feature women protagonists. I think in the 4 years since, we're seeing more, but especially the confluence of gender equality and women in science is still such a slim portion.
We're going to have to say goodbye. That's a good point to end on. Thank you, Maria.
Thank you so
being
much
with
for
us, Maria Popova, editor and founder of brainpickings.org, and Jacob Berkowitz, author of books for kids and adults, including Jurassic Poop, What Dinosaurs and Others Left Behind. I think we know what that's going to be about. Thank you, Jacob.
My treat. Thank you.
For taking time to be with us today.